You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show...
These are individuals who carried out an act of terrorism, and they later tried to justify that act of terrorism by invoking the religion of Islam and their own deviant view of it.
The White House is steering clear of labeling the Paris terror attack radical Islam, so just how important are words and terminology in combating terrorism? To discuss that, I'm joined by Martin Plaut and Samira Shackle, also on the program.
Boko Haram is without question one of the most evil and threatening terrorist entities on the planet today.
With reports this week that Boko Haram are using kidnapped schoolgirls as suicide bombers, we ask if it's time the West responded to this growing threat in the African continent. And coming up a little later, we'll check in with Monocle's Josh Fennert, who is at Pitiuomo Trade Fair in Florence.
It's where a lot of the business gets done, where a lot of the buyers from Tokyo, from the big department stores to the department stores in London, actually buy the collections and buy the things that they hope people will be stocking their closets with come autumn.
All that plus a look at the news weeklies in Brazil and an insight into the world of books. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Funerals have been held for four people killed in last week's attack in Paris on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo by militant Islamists. Friends and family paid last respects to cartoonist Bernard Verlac, known as Tinu, and Georges Walensky, as well as a columnist and a policeman. 17 people died in the attacks, which were claimed by Al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, dozens of Pakistani lawmakers have been marching in the capital, Islamabad, decrying the publication of Prophet Muhammad cartoons in Charlie Hebdo. Earlier, Pakistan's assembly passed a resolution condemning publication of the cartoons. Pakistan's Minister for Railways, Khawaja Rafiq, presented the resolution to the lower house of parliament.
This house strongly condemns printing and reprinting of blasphemy caricatures of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, by the French journal, and also take serious note of the continued trend of their reproduction in numerous other newspapers and magazines of other Western capitals.
Belgian public television channel RTBF is reporting on its website that three people have been killed during a police counter-terrorism raid in Verviers in the east of the country. The Belgian news agency has quoted federal prosecutors saying there has been a police operation near the centre of the town, but they've not confirmed any casualties. Belgar says police activity is still going on. Witnesses have reported hearing gunfire and at least three explosions. It's unclear if the raid is connected with last week's attacks in Paris. Dozens of protesters have halted morning traffic in Washington to raise their voices against what they call militarized and racially biased policing. The march, organized by a group called DC Ferguson, has been held on the anniversary of the birth of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot," and holding banners, protesters walked through downtown Washington during the morning rush hour as police kept traffic at bay. Switzerland has sent shockwaves through financial markets by allowing its currency to trade freely against the euro. The Swiss National Bank says it's removing a cap of 1.2 Swiss francs to the euro, which was introduced during the eurozone crisis in 2011, when a flood of cash was sent for refuge in the traditional safe haven. Switzerland has been worried a rapid appreciation in its currency, sometimes known as the Swissie, would hit exporters and cause deflation in its economy. James Bevan from the British CCLA Charities Investments Fund says the SNB's decision makes no sense.
I was completely wrong-footed by the Swiss National Bank's decisions. They said very firmly just a month ago that they were committed to defending the current levels and that the negative interest rate strategy was part of a longer-term and deeply considered move. Therefore, what they have done today makes no sense, and I'm absolutely confident they will have to take steps now to stop the headlong appreciation of the Swissie against the euro.
US officials have announced new travel and trade rules between the US and Cuba will take effect on Friday. The measures include allowing US citizens to use credit cards in Cuba and for US businesses to export some technologies. Americans will be able to take home up to $100 in alcohol and tobacco from Cuba. Observers say it means the US ban on Cuban cigars is over. The list of nominees for next month's Oscars has been announced in Los Angeles. Birdman and the Grand Budapest Hotel have both received 9 nominations, including Best Actor for Michael Keaton in Birdman. Also nominated for Best Actor are the UK's Benedict Cumberbatch and Eddie Redmayne for their roles in The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything. Both films are up for Best Film. The Best Actress nominees include Julianne Moore, Reese Witherspoon, Marion Cotillard, and two Britons, Rosamund Pike and Felicity Jones. Veteran actor Robert Duvall is nominated for Best Supporting Actor at the age of 84, while Meryl Streep is up for Best Supporting Actress, her 19th Oscar nomination. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07 and it is 13.07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Martin Plaut, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and British journalist who was formerly based in Pakistan, Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. After last week's terror attacks in France, the White House has been very careful in selecting its language, preferring not to label the attack as radical Islam. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest had this to say on the issue.
The first is accuracy. We want to describe exactly what happened. These are individuals who carried out an act of terrorism, and they later tried to justify that act of terrorism by invoking the religion of Islam and their own deviant view of it. The second is, this is an act that was roundly condemned by Muslim leaders. We also don't want to be in a situation where we are legitimizing what we consider to be a completely illegitimate justification for this violence.
That was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest earlier. And indeed, instead of using the term radical Islam, the White House is using the term violent extremism. Martin Plaut, if I start with you, what do you think about all this? What do you think President Obama is getting at here by backing away from this religious extremist angle?
Well, I think one can take them at face value. I think they point out quite correctly that there are a lot of religious leaders, Muslim religious leaders, who've come out saying, you know, that they don't represent my views. So why blame the whole of Islam for what is one tiny sect and, you know, sort of whitewash everybody? But I mean, to be honest, I think this is just insane. I think this is political correctness gone bonkers. But I mean, this is not why the right is having a go at President Obama about this. This is just the latest in a long, long, long line of attacks that they make on President Obama, frankly, because he is black and because he has brought in things like the health service. And, you know, they would use any weapon under the sun. And that is really the beginning and the end of it. They don't care about whether what the label. It's just the latest thing that they've picked up.
Exactly. This may well be about domestic politics. Samira Shackle, what do you think about this term then?
Well, I think that it's sort of clear, as Martin says, what they're doing, which is trying to reframe the debate and sort of taking away the idea that that all Muslims can be tarred with this brush of terrorist or sort of be associated with it, when to many Muslims it's an aberration of their faith, what happened. But I think it's come out slightly garbled and maybe slightly derailed the debate, just because to sort of suddenly, after well over a decade of governments in the US, the UK, elsewhere in Europe, engaging in this sort of discourse of a clash of civilizations and so on, talking a lot about radical Islam and so on, it seems like an odd moment to suddenly try to sort of make this this change to change to the terminology that's used. And I think the other thing is that the message slightly gets lost. I think it's quite a laudable aim, probably, to try and reframe that a little bit, because I think it's this idea that causes quite a lot of resentment, that whenever there's a white terrorist like Anders Breivik, say, or like Ryan McGee, the British soldier who was recently jailed for sort of accumulating weapons, then they're seen as a lone wolf, whereas when it's a Muslim terrorist, even if it's someone with sort of clear mental health problems, not affiliated to any group, then they're seen as part of a wider problem that's taken as emblematic of their generation, their community, and so on. However, I think that the point sort of has slightly got lost in what Josh Earnest said, because, his words, whether that's taken out of context or not, his words have been taken to mean that he's sort of saying that this ideology doesn't exist at all, when clearly it does. I mean, that ideology certainly isn't representative of all Muslims, but it is something that's there.
If we look at these things more widely, Martin, what do you think? How important are words and terminology in the global commentary on extremism and terrorism?
Well, extremely. I mean, this is one of the battlegrounds, and clearly they think it's important as to what you call things. So do we. This is one of the fault lines in the way that we are fighting these issues. But I mean, I'm not going to hear any lessons from the Republican right and the sort of, Fox about this kind of issue. These are the people who only a few years ago were relabeling, French fries as freedom fries, for goodness sake. These people have no credibility whatsoever. Yeah, and people of their ilk were suggesting that Birmingham was an entirely Muslim city and that there were parts of London that Christians couldn't go to. I mean, this is just rubbish.
Do you think it's going to change the way we see what's been going on in the world during the last years, when we look as one example, how President Obama has also been steering away from the term war on terror, putting him at odds with his Republican predecessors? Are we perhaps going to see this what we've been calling war of terror as something else? Not a war, but more of a long-term operation?
Well, I think that I think it is a long-term operation already. I mean, this has been something that's going on since 2001, and it's a sort of war without a clear beginning, middle or end, which I think is quite a strange state for the world to be in. I think moving away from that terminology is broadly a good thing, because I think that there's so much bad feeling associated with the war on terror. If you think about, I think for many Muslim communities, for instance, in the US and the UK, not even taking into account the international associations of that word, but just within sort of the domestic context, it's associated with an erosion of civil liberties, with widespread surveillance and sort of targeting entire populations as suspect communities. So I think that there's a huge lot of baggage with that terminology. And so moving away from it, whether that signifies a new strategy or not, probably is a good thing.
A healthy move. Well, let's continue with Russia next, which is set to celebrate the 70th anniversary of its victory over Nazi Germany by inviting world leaders to a parade in Red Square. However, one potential guest is causing quite a stir already. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is apparently mulling over his invitation and is looking increasingly likely to attend. And not surprisingly, US President Barack Obama plans to stay home. Vladimir Putin has been an outcast on the world stage for some time. What are your thoughts? Samira, is this invitation to Kim Jong-un simply another way of causing discomfort for Western leaders?
Well, I think it's probably partly that, and I'd say partly also an indication of the fact that Russia is wanting to strengthen its alliances in Asia, not just with North Korea, with other countries in Asia too. And that's, partly just a strategy that it has in terms of foreign policy, partly, I'm sure, sort of sped along by the fact that relations with the West are deteriorating so much.
Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I must say, I do find it a bit odd that President Obama is not intending to go. This was, one of the great victories over fascism, and we should all celebrate that. And it is sad that he's not going, that relations are so bad. But I suppose this is, you're not interested. You want to know about Kim Jong-un, about whom I don't know a lot. But then, having looked through the material, it doesn't seem that very many people know a great deal about this man anyway. I agree. I mean, clearly Putin is trying to have an opening to the East and move towards the East rather than the kind of Western allies that Gorbachev was trying to invoke. But of course, one shouldn't forget that Russia does actually have a border with North Korea. So it's hardly surprising that they want to invite them along. It may be a short border, but they do have one.
By the way, I have to say that when you said it's awkward that Obama is not going to Russia, I agree to a certain extent. But at the same time, I'm wondering what kind of a party would it be? Can you imagine if President Obama was there and Kim Jong-un as well?
Yeah, but some things are above, above these kind of issues. And I think the victory over fascism, and perhaps, it was the one moment when Russia, or the Soviet Union as it then was, and the West were united. And one shouldn't forget that moment.
You remind us that indeed North Korea is Russia's neighbour, but how much can Putin actually gain from good relations with North Korea, considering in which situation North Korea is? This country is basically bankrupt.
Yeah, it's a bit of it's a bit more of a mysterious move on Putin's part, I guess. He's actually, I think he was the first Russian leader to make a visit to North Korea in the year 2000. It's not a brand new thing. I think there's clearly more to gain for North Korea than for Russia because, I think the reports are that North Korea is anxious about being overly dependent on China, who's traditionally its strongest ally. It was also interesting that this will be Kim Jong-un's first state visit. I mean, he'll be going to Russia before he's gone to China, which is traditionally the strongest ally. So I don't know whether that perhaps indicates a shift in alliance from North Korea, but there's certainly a clearer gain for North Korea from the alliance than Russia, I think.
There's one intriguing question, which is how would he get there? Because his father certainly hated flying and apparently never would go. He would go only by train. So is he going to go all the way by train? This would take quite a long time. Let's see what happens.
Well, Marcy, what do you think, by the way? What kind of signal would Kim give to the world if he were to choose Russia as a destination for his first trip abroad as the leader of North Korea?
Well, perhaps it would indicate that he's more secure, because he has, after all, bumped off a lot of his predecessors and his opponents within the regime. A lot of them being executed, some of them by machine gun. And the question is, I suppose, you don't leave your country if you feel insecure. So perhaps it would indicate that he has some feeling of security and that he's in control of the regime.
We've seen during the last months, when it's been going quite bad for Russia, we have seen Putin trying to create better relations, not just with North Korea, but also with, say, China. Do you think there are other countries that Putin would try to get closer?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of the third world countries, or what used to be called the third world countries, developing countries, with whom he might have better relations. And I mean, for example, South Africa's President Zuma is quite keen to have better relations with the Russians and has been there. But this seems to have trodden a few Chinese toes, which causes some problems. So, there is scope clearly to have a wider set of friends than, just your immediate neighbours. But, the problem for Putin is oil, and his money is running out at a rapid rate. And the fall in the Saudi decision to go on pumping the stuff is an absolute death blow for the Russian economy. And how's he going to cope with that? I think that must be his number one problem.
Samira, you mentioned earlier that indeed if Kim goes to Russia, chooses Russia as his first destination for a trip abroad, about that signal, what do you think China is going to think about that if Kim goes there instead of China?
Well, I guess it's a bit of a snub to China. I mean, that's how it would quite widely be interpreted, I think. I always think it's quite interesting, the sort of baggage that goes with diplomatic state visits. It seems just quite an arbitrary thing to me, but I have no pretenses to being a diplomat, I guess. But yeah, I think it would be seen as a snub to China. And it's not the first sort of move that North Korea is making towards improved relationships with Russia. I think there was at some point last year or perhaps the year before, it was announced that they were going to pursue some joint military and agricultural projects with Russia, which would, I guess, have the effect of making North Korea less dependent on China. So I think this would just be another step adding to that.
Let's continue with a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sipi, Samira Shekel and Martin Plaut. When we return, we'll discuss the escalating situation involving Boko Haram in Nigeria.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the U.S. and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 21:20 in St. Petersburg, 18:20 in London and 13:20 in Washington, D.C. Still with me are Martin Plaut and Samira Shackle. To Nigeria now, where there are reports this week that terrorist group Boko Haram is resorting to an unimaginable form of horror, abducting schoolgirls as young as 10 for use as suicide bombers. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry had this to say on the development.
Boko Haram is without question one of the most evil and threatening terrorist entities on the planet today. And I even discussed this morning with the Foreign Minister of Great Britain, Philip Hammond, the possibility of he and I engaging in a special initiative with respect to Nigeria and with respect to Boko Haram.
This week saw the torching of tens of towns across Nigeria, leaving around 2,000 people unaccounted for. And as we just heard, John Kerry and UK Foreign Minister Philip Hammond are considering a joint initiative against Boko Haram. Samira Shackle, is it high time Western nations got involved in this unravelling situation?
I think that it depends heavily what the action is, but it's certainly evident that the Nigerian government and military are not able or willing to tackle the Boko Haram threat effectively. You know, it's been quite a long time now since Goodluck Jonathan, the president, declared war on Boko Haram. I think it was in 2013, and that's had pretty much no effect, I think, on, you know, that it's a state where Boko Haram still essentially has power over a large swathe of the northeast of the country and where they can commit horrible crimes with impunity. So I think it's certainly time that something happened and that something changed. I think it's quite important to think about what that action would be. And, you know, the Nigerian army is grossly undertrained and underfunded, and that's largely because of corruption. The quite substantial military budget ends up going into the pockets of top officers and not into training frontline staff. So I think that's also something that has to be taken into account in planning and international assistance, because quite often that takes the form of military aid or of training soldiers and so on. So I think it's clear that something needs to change, whether that's a regional force or a Western force or whatever, going in to provide sort of capacity building and assistance. But it's obviously Kerry didn't give any details of what it would be.
Indeed, no details were given. Martin Plaut, what are your thoughts? What would be, difficult question, what would be the best thing to be done in this situation?
You know, there really is almost no answer to that question, and it is the most depressing situation. You know, I've covered Africa for nearly 30 years, and it is one of the most depressing situations that I've ever come across. I think the only hope in reality is democracy. And I say that with great caution, because Nigerian democracy is a strange beast and has, you know, failed on many occasions. But, you know, if Muhammadu Buhari wins the election and Jonathan is kicked out, it might, just might, be a turning point. Because one shouldn't forget that many in the north who are Muslim see Jonathan as a usurper who was a Christian. It was the Muslims and the northerners' turn to take power, and he only came to power because of the death of the previous president. So he was illegitimate. He has done absolutely nothing to, you know, help the North, and people like Muhammad Yusuf, who founded Boko Haram and was slaughtered by the police when they got him in custody in 2009, leading to the appalling tragedy that we see today. Buhari is somebody who is a much, much more substantial figure than Jonathan, and perhaps that would do something.
And what could the West do to support democracy in Nigeria?
You know, Nigerians have to run Nigeria. No, nobody else can do it from the outside. I mean, look, the special forces answer and, you know, the boots on the ground can do something. It did a lot in Mali. It could do something in, you know, a place like Ivory Coast. But Nigeria, you can't deal with Nigeria. I mean, only the Nigerians can deal with Nigeria. And I'm afraid until they do it, it ain't going to happen.
Is there a danger that, should Boko Haram not be stopped or at least curbed now, that they may grow to become a threat to the scale of ISIS or even worse?
Well, I think in the region it certainly is a threat already to the scale of ISIS. I mean, they've got a self-declared caliphate. It's got about 1.5 million people living in that area. So I think it's something that's underreported on and perhaps is considered to be sort of further away from us politically. But it certainly is something that's on a huge scale and causing a huge amount of misery there. I think that in terms of Western responses and sort of Western discussion of these terrorist groups, there can be a tendency towards a quite myopic view where it's only considered to be important if it has some sort of bearing on us. And I think even a lot of the discussion of ISIS is slightly misleading in that respect because, you know, while there is this very real problem of foreign-born jihadis going and joining and returning and so on, it's not, you know, targeting the West currently isn't ISIS's primary focus. Its primary focus is regional. And I think Boko Haram is certainly a very localised group now. Who knows what could happen in the future, but it's a local threat for the moment.
Just one thing that the Americans could do or the West could do is to put pressure on Chad. Because if you ask yourself, which is the country in which there isn't trouble, Chad is not in trouble. And one of the reasons is that it's funneling and being used as a backdoor for Boko Haram. Put pressure on the Chadians.
Well, of course, Nigeria is not the only country where terrorist groups have been on the rise. Now, both Pakistan and India have struggled to contain growing threats, with Pakistan this week accusing its neighbour of having, quote, designs against Pakistan by assisting terrorist groups. The Pakistani minister who made this accusation failed to provide any evidence to support his claims, though. Samira, a quick analysis. Is this just rhetoric, or do you think India would indeed be assisting terrorist groups?
I think it's not really anything new to have these kind of this sort of trading of accusations between Pakistan and India. It's something that's gone back decades and decades, and it's more frequently India accusing Pakistan of supporting terrorist groups over its borders, which is actually true. You know, you've seen it, and most notably the attack on the Taj Hotel in Mumbai in 2008. There is also a sort of policy within segments of the Pakistani Secret Service of funding terrorist groups who sort of serve its interests overseas. Whether or not there is a terrorist group active in India that's, as a sort of reverse thing taking action in Pakistan, I couldn't really say. But certainly, I think that Pakistani ministers who make statements like this have more of an interest in deflecting attention away from their own sort of incompetence in tackling the homegrown militancy problem. So it's a very easy excuse to say it's coming from Afghanistan, it's coming from India and so on.
Well, regardless whether this claim is true or not, this claim of this Pakistani minister, it still seems that terrorist organisations are prospering in struggling economies where poverty and lawlessness are common. Martin, how much of an impact could foreign aid or business investment have in improving the chances for all these nations to battle homegrown terrorist threats?
I think they can, and it does. It clearly is part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer, because one shouldn't forget that, you know, really Wahhabism, which, you know, is one of the ideologies behind a lot of what is going on, grew out of Saudi Arabia, which had plenty of money. And, you know, it was there, the flows of their money into places like Somalia that led to Al-Shabaab, which has nothing, whose ideology has nothing to do with Somalia. So, you know, it is part of the answer, but one has to be more careful and more nuanced in one's assessment.
I think it can be hugely effective, actually. I'd agree with Martin, it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all, but certainly I think economic disenfranchisement, political disenfranchisement, poor education and so on, all these things are certainly huge contributing factors. And, you know, there's no one answer. As I said earlier, these are all sort of localised groups which have their individual context from which they've sprung and reasons that need to be addressed differently in different places. But I think there are certain commonalities. You know, the the fact that lots of these people are just don't feel engaged in the political spectrum and don't have education, don't have jobs, and so on. These are the foot soldiers who are recruited to the ideology. So I think you can do a huge amount by working on those underlying factors, easing sort of community relations, making sure there's a genuinely inclusive political process, and improving education and economic economic self-sustainability.
Samira Shackle and Martin Plaut, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is still plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. In just a moment, we will flick through some of the fresh news weeklies from Brazil. But before we get started on that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest news.
And funerals have been held for four people killed in last week's attack in Paris on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo by militant Islamists. Meanwhile, dozens of Pakistani lawmakers have been marching in the capital Islamabad, decrying the publication of Prophet Muhammad cartoons in the magazine. Belgian public television channel RTBF is reporting on its website that three people have been killed during a police counter-terrorism raid in Verviers in the east of the country. It's unclear if the raid is connected with last week's attacks in Paris. Dozens of protesters have halted morning traffic in Washington to raise their voices against what they call militarised and racially biased policing. The march, organised by a group called DC Ferguson, has been held on the anniversary of the birth of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. And Switzerland has sent shockwaves through financial markets by allowing its currency to trade freely against the euro. The Swiss National Bank says it's removing a cap of 1.2 Swiss francs to the euro, which was introduced during the Eurozone crisis in 2011, when a flood of cash was sent for refuge in the traditional safe haven. Those are the latest stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill Bingham, even. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now for a look at what's making news in Brazil's weekly news magazines. And to discuss this, I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, let's start straight away with Brazil's biggest selling weekly, Veja is the name. I understand, like most of the world's press, also this magazine is having the events of Charlie Hebdo as the dominant topic.
Absolutely, Marcos. So it's very interesting. Let's start with Veja. In fact, before I talk about their coverage of Charlie Hebdo, I just want to say that actually Veja is the second best-selling weekly in the world. I think they're just behind Time magazine. So they sell 1.2 million copies every week. So it's an incredibly successful magazine in the country. Veja is to the right in the political spectrum, so they're also very critical of the government. And it's a very interesting coverage. As you can see here on the cover, they have like pencils and pens like in the format of a gun, and you know, they say you should use your weapons, citizens, you know, and the weapons are, you know, of course, the pens, and it's very interesting that they republished all the cartoons of the magazine,
all cartoons,
even the most controversial ones. And that's very interesting, because when I came back to the UK, I just came back from Brazil 2 days ago, I know there's been this discussion in some papers. They did show the you know, some of the cartoons, but the majority of them did not. But in the Brazilian press, I felt a different thing, you know. So they were republishing, they said it's freedom of expression, they have the right to do that. But you have to remember that Brazil has a kind of a small Muslim community. I don't think it's such a sensitive issue as it is in Europe.
Exactly. When you talk about those most controversial cartoons published by Charlie Hebdo, obviously we have a Prophet Muhammad there printed. What else? What are those other cartoons published?
Well, for example, they were also trying to say that actually the magazine does not only make fun of the Prophet. You know, so for example, here on page 61, they have three covers of different Charlie Hebdo issues. And for example, there's one making fun of the Pope, actually, you know, saying that you should, you know, one bishop is just saying sorry, you know, they're talking about pedophilia crimes. And then the Pope says, oh, you should do cinema like Polanski, for example. Again, very controversial. And there's another one making fun of Marine Le Pen as well. So, you know, it's they're basically trying to say that the magazine, you know, because most Brazilians didn't know the magazine as everyone else. So they're trying to explain that the magazine is irreverent with everyone, basically.
How sensitive an audience are Brazilians, by the way, for example, when you go and print the Pope in that context? Do people get shocked?
It's interesting because at the same time that we're showing those cartoons, actually, Brazilian humor is very light, actually. So we don't have this culture of satire as you see in France and even sometimes in the UK. So it's interesting that they're publishing that because it's not really part of our culture to have those kind of controversial. So yes, I never seen like a Brazilian comedian making fun of the Pope. Of course, you can have a light-hearted fun, but not the way Charlie Hebdo does, for example.
Exactly. Let's continue. There is a supplement actually attached to Veja every week. And what is the latest one?
And that's actually why I buy the magazine. Because I have to say, Marcos, even though it's a successful magazine, I don't like it very much. I do think they're too conservative to my taste. But they do have this supplement called Veja São Paulo, which is, you know, it's like a timeout for the city you live. They have the Rio version, they have the Brasilia version, all the major Brazilian capital cities. And I think it's a fun magazine. They tell you which restaurant you should go, which cinemas you should go. And they're telling, you know, of course, it's the first issue, the second issue of 2015. They're giving tips, 15 franchises that are going to work in São Paulo in 2015.
Give me an example.
Well, I'll give you an example. For example, a gym for the silver community. Of course, the Brazilian population is aging, so there is a gym called Be Active. They already have 6 in the city, but they want to expand to another 9.
So there's an age limit. How old do you need to be to become a member?
You have to be at least 60 years old.
And what are they like, those gyms?
Well, of course, they are thinking, because of course they're a bit older, so they have to be careful, so they have all the lifts. So, you know, it's all made to accommodate those clients. And it is a big trend in Brazil. There was even a story, I think I read in Veja or Folha de São Paulo, about the silver surfers, that a lot of people after 70, they're learning how to surf.
I can imagine you being like that when you turn 60.
So it be active. I'll be your client in a few years' time.
Let's turn to another magazine you have for today. It's called, if I pronounce it right, Epoca.
Epoca magazine, which, if you can see on the cover, is very similar to the German magazine Focus. They have a global, a global here in the letter O. And it's a very bloody cover, again, about Charlie Hebdo, but it's a different cover from Veja. It's called the Freedom of Expression Has Been Executed. So they were again very shocked, and you can see some of the cartoons here as well. But, you know, talking more about the magazine itself, what I like about it, it's a little bit like The Economist here in the UK, where the first thing the magazine is some editorials. So basically they're showing the magazine's opinion about the main topics of the week. So I think that's quite interesting, because with Veja, even though they're conservative, you don't really know their views on the topics.
So what does Epoca write then? Can I give me an example of, you know, what's there?
May I talk about one of my favorite columnists, actually? She's always right at the back page of the magazine. Her name is Ruth de Aquino. And I have to say, she wrote a very good column in this piece, even though I'm not sure if I agree, because basically, you know, our president Dilma Rousseff, she was re-elected. And on the 1st of January, you know, there was the whole ceremony, and she wore what for me was a lovely dress, actually. But it caused so much controversy in the country.
And that's something female politicians often face. No one's ever criticizing male politicians, but be it women wearing something, they get the crap.
Exactly. And actually, there's been a lot of criticism of people who criticize Dilma Rousseff and her clothes choice. But then Ruth de Aquino, she said, I have the right to criticize Dilma if I wanted.
Why?
And she say, because she says she criticized also male politicians.
Has she done it?
And she's done it. You know, Aécio Neves, who was, you know, the second candidate in the presidential election, he did put some Botox on, you know, and she said, I think it was a bit excessive. And he was. But and of course, you know.
So there was not a lot of movement in his face.
The president of Senate as well, he's becoming bald, and then he did some transplant. So, you know, she criticized as well. She said, you know, I can criticize Dilma if I want to.
Let's continue, because we still have one magazine left.
And it's a smaller one. It's called Carta Capital. It's more to the left. I think it's a very good magazine, but of course it sells much less. I believe they sell around 50,000 copies a week, of course, so definitely not like Vision. And they don't, the cover is not about Charlie Hebdo. The cover actually, it's about Petrobras, which is our national oil company, which is undergoing a huge corruption scandal at the moment. So, you know, I think it's quite a long story. It's quite wordy, the magazine, you know. There's not so many pictures, but it is an interesting story nevertheless. And they always have a different, you know, they have different stories from Epoca and Veja, for example.
They do have some regular features as well, and I've already heard you mention earlier there's something in the back of the magazine always.
Again, the back page. It's my favorite because, you know, it's called Retratos Capitais. So
exactly.
Basically, every issue they choose like an iconic character in Brazil, and they portray a very beautiful picture, and sometimes there's a little story as well. And this time it's this lady, Dona Dodô, which is, she's an iconic samba dancer in Brazil. And, you know, as you can see from her age, I believe she's in her 80s, and she dances for Portela, which is a very traditional samba school in Rio de Janeiro. So they decided to do an homage to her, you know, because we Carnival is coming as well. And actually, I believe if Charlie Hebdo didn't happen, the covers would be much happier, because this is the silly season in Brazil. Mm-hmm. It's summer, it's hot, but, you know, because of Charlie Hebdo, of course, things changed. But otherwise, it would be like diet tips and how to be the queen of Carnival, something like that.
It's quite refreshing that we didn't have diet tips this time when we did this roundup with
maybe
you.
Maybe next time
when you are in the studio. Thank you. That was Monaco's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And you are listening to Midori House on Monaco 24. Up next, we'll check in with the Florentine menswear show Pitti Uomo.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monaco's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Now to Florence, Italy, where the menswear trade show Pitti Uomo is in full swing. Here the world's leading fashion retailers, buyers and editors meet to view upcoming collections. Monaco's Josh Fennert is in Florence and joins me now on the phone. Hello, Josh. Let's start by hearing your description of what exactly is going on there at Pitti Uomo today.
Hi, Marcus. Yeah, I think you've done a very good job of giving a bit of the background, but if I can add a little bit of the colour to it, as you mentioned, Pitti Uomo is a biannual menswear trade show where basically anyone who's anyone in the fashion world has to come to see the autumn-winter collections. And it's where a lot of the business gets done, where a lot of the buyers from the shops in Tokyo, from the big department stores to the department stores in London, actually buy the collections and buy the things that they hope people will be stocking their closets with come autumn. And it's been going on for over 40 years. And it's kind of different from other trade shows in the sense that it's not in an out-of-town, big, soulless exhibition centre somewhere. It's right in the middle of Florence, near the train station, at an old 16th-century kind of fortress. And that's where that's very much where the kind of action happens. I was lucky enough to be at an interview with the fair's director today, Raffaello Napoleone, who mentioned a lot of the preliminary figures, which look very promising this year. So 24,000 buyers visited, 20% more than this time last year.
It's going really well indeed. I wonder how much that has got to do with the time when this fair is getting organised. I've understood that some previous instalments have been clashing with some other fashion shows. Is that the case this year as well?
It's actually not the case this year, but it's been an ongoing topic of much contention. I mean, traditionally, Pitti Uomo has been the premier menswear fashion show in the sense that it has always been first in the calendar and it has also been the most important. But in the past, I think two or three years, the London Collections Men has attracted some of the brands that may have debuted their collections at Pitti to London. And I believe last year and the year before, there was actually a bit of overlap, which caused some concern. But when I spoke to the fair's director today, he said that he was very happy that there is this kind of challenge from London, if you will. I think he feels that it makes the market stronger and it focuses the kind of European menswear scene. And I feel like this year, Pitti hasn't had to prove so much that it is the first in the calendar, but more that its kind of inherent strength has come to the fore a little bit. People go to both of them, actually, when they're scheduled consecutively. So I think there's less of a conflict than people might have feared.
Josh, basing on what you've seen so far, can you tell us a little about the menswear market?
Well, I think all signs are pretty positive, although Italy's economy isn't going particularly strong. There's been a huge amount of buying and selling here, particularly from in Europe. I think the only markets that are down are Russia and Ukraine, for pretty obvious political reasons. But Germany and Japan have bought very strongly based on the first couple of days' takings. And, Italy too. So I think the market's definitely on the up.
Good news. And what are some of the highlights you've seen so far?
Well, it's very hard to get an overview after one day. And obviously, myself, our design editor, Tom, and fashion director, Daphne Azard, will be scouring the stalls for further finds. But a couple of things that caught my eye today were an Italian brand called Presidents, which is made here in Florence. It's a jeans and kind of outerwear brand. And I spoke to the creative director, Guido Bondi. And I think that's a great collection, which we should be kind of watching for. There are a couple of new people as well. Readers of Monocle will be very familiar with a German brand called Mersby Schwanen, who've been making kind of a German hand-loomed underwear since 1911. But they've decided that, that traditional business model is all well and good, but they're going to show up Pitti for the first time to try and push themselves out to the market and to kind of sell to other countries. So it's very much a mixed bag. We've seen a lot of good things from Japan. Italy always shows very strongly. But the UK actually has also done very well. Private White, who are a company based up in Manchester, have showed a great outerwear collection and a new collaboration with J. Crew, a new parka designed by Nick Ashley, which I think will go well. And British designer Nigel Caborn also has done a collaboration with a British outerwear brand called Carrymore, who have made an excellent parka and set of bags. So I think the British have shown well, and I think the variety has very much been testament to the success of the show so far.
Well, Josh, it's almost 8 o'clock in Florence already. Tell me, before I let you go, what happens when the business gets done every day? How do the participants of Pitti Uomo actually relax during the evenings?
Well, I think they find it very easy to relax. As I mentioned, because the fair is right in the middle of town, there's a huge flood that kind of overtakes the city. And while people talk about the deals all day, I think they tend to be sealed at night. And they tend to be sealed in the bars around town over long dinners. And yeah, the festivities sort of look after themselves, I think.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennert as Pitti Uomo in Florence. Thank you very much. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We continue with a bit of music. We just heard from the Pitti Uomo in Florence, a city home to Gucci and Salvatore Ferragamo, among others. So in keeping with our classical style theme today, let's hear a track celebrating all that's good about Italy. This is Cinema Italiano, as performed by Kate Hudson from the musical Nine.
I love the play of light, the way Contini puts his image through a prism. I feel my body chill, gives me a special thrill each time I see that Guido neorealism. I love the dark and handsome guys with the skinny little ties dressing mod looking out of sight. I love to watch them as they cruise with their pointy leather shoes wearing shades in the middle of the night. Whatever Guido does, it makes him smile. He is the essence of Italian style. I love the glamorous Latin world, but only Guido can portray Contini cinema Italiano. I love his cinema Italiano. He makes me feel with cinema Italiano. My life is real with cinema Italiano. He is the king of cinema Italiano.
POV. There's no one else with his unique director's vision. His angles wide and tight, each moment feels so right. Defines Italian style by only his decision. I love the speedy little cars, the hip coffee bars, the sleek women in Positano. Guido's the ultimate Uomo Romano. Shades in the middle of the night. Speedy little cars, hip hop bars. Sleep! Women in Boston time!
Wow, that was Kate Hudson performing Cinema Italiano, the standout number from the musical Nine. You're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. Time now for our daily Ars review, and today we talk books, and here in the studio to give us her insights is literary editor for The Independent, Arifa Akbar. Welcome to the programme.
Hello.
So first, you would like to talk about a book that was actually published over 100 years ago, but has been reissued this month.
And extremely relevant this year because Emmeline Pankhurst, in 1914, put out her story called Suffragette, My Own Story. She was, of course, the woman that found the militant wing of the suffragettes who were fighting for getting a women their vote. And this year, she's going to be huge because Meryl Streep's playing her in a film. That film doesn't come out till October, but you know how the book becomes the, you know, the book of the film. I don't want it to happen to this because this book really should be read on its own. Not, we shouldn't rely on Meryl Streep to tell us what this book's about. It's really about the life of this woman born in Manchester, Emmeline Pankhurst, to very progressive parents. And she gives us her account of militant activism. And I think a lot of us think of suffragettes as these women, you know, women in black and white pictures with bonnets on them, chaining themselves up to whatever, you know, off Parliament Square. But if you read this story, it is honestly, and I've read a lot of shocking stories and very violent stories, but this is actually quite a shocking in how violent they were, but perhaps more alarmingly, how violent the authority was to them. Mm-hmm. You know, the violence in the... She's fantastic. She is the queen of understatement, emotional understatement. So it's very emotionally understated. Women are being beaten up and brutalized and force-fed and they're dying and they really are being whacked over the head by policemen at these protests and all sorts of dragged across the street. And she's sort of saying, we were met with some very rough horseplay and things like that. And she calls herself a hooligan. She advocates guerrilla warfare. This is why it's relevant to us.
That sounds really interesting. I'm really curious, you mentioned that one of the reasons why this book has been reissued is that the film comes out in October.
Yeah.
Is there any references to the film when you browse through this book?
It's funny you should ask. I was appalled by the fact that my copy of this book, the paperback,
mentions no less than four times on the cover and the flaps.
Seriously?
Seriously. Four times. This is the book of the best-selling... this is the book of the, you know, Meryl Streep's film. And I'm sure the film will be fabulous, but you know...
But we don't want to remember the story only from the film.
Precisely.
Exactly. Let's move on, because we've got a few more books to talk about, actually.
Yeah.
Next, The Vegetarian by Hong Kong. And I'm quite curious about this book, because the plot is quite interesting. There is a woman who decides to give up meat, and as a result, she devastates two families. How on earth does that happen?
Well, actually, it's in a strange way, it actually ties into a little bit of Pankhurst and the force feeding, but it's a curious, it's a lean, strange story, beautifully written, quietly alarming, you know, and again, very violent in its own way. A woman, just a wife, a youngish wife of a perfectly successful couple, if slightly, it's a hollow marriage, and the husband clearly doesn't love her. Anyway, she decides to give up meat after having a dream. Everything after that, I mean, it becomes more and more extreme, her giving up meat, because then she gives up, she becomes a vegan, and then eventually she becomes emaciated and gives up food. But what I think it's so good at doing is showing us how protest is played out through the body. This is a South Korean, you know, book, and South Korean, the way that Hang Khan shows us South Korean society is very highly ordered, gendered, and what this woman does is, in a way, she refuses to become and to stay. She's a very obedient wife. She refuses to stay this obedient wife. So there's a brilliant scene where she goes to her husband's boss's dinner party. She turns up braless. She's emaciated and pale. And the other wives stare at her. She refuses to eat a thing. She's stony and silent. And this is the way her protest plays out.
That sounds really good. That was The Vegetarian by Hong Kong. And we have to rush forward, actually, because we've got two more books. Next book we're talking about is The Room. It is by Jonas Karlsson, or Jonas Karlsson, as he would say in Sweden, because he's Swedish.
Yes, that's right. And apparently he's big in Sweden. It's this quite a lean story. It's under 200 pages long. It's about an office worker, Bjorn. And he's like something out of Kafka, honestly. He works for a company which is called The Authority. He's quite an oddball, and colleagues know that the minute he walks in. As you know, we all have a sort of oddball, and we gang up against them a little in an office, I think. And this, what he discovers a room next to the men's loos that really opens up his mind and his imagination. But the problem is, according to the other colleagues, there is no such room. There is no such room next to the loos. This is a fabulous book about creativity, how it's stifled in an office space. We're having Blue Monday on the 26th of January. Is the officially the most depressing day of the year. And people should read this, because it says so much about office life, the pain of conformity and being an outsider.
Amazing. And finally, quickly, Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant. Ishiguro, of course, the author of Remains of the Day and yes. Never Let Me Go.
Yes.
Expectations might be high for this one. Does it pay off?
You know what? I started reading it and I thought, oh God, this is about Britain of the past. It's about medieval, you know, the medieval past. Gawain Gawain the Green Knight turns up at one point. Goblins, fairies, ogres. This is, you know, it could have been, I hate fantasy novels and I could have hated it. What Ishiguro is so, so good at doing is bringing a really emotionally impactful realism to these things. You know, he wrote Never Let Me Go, which is really an alien, it's a sort of bizarre SF story, sci-fi story. But he just brings such realism to it. So you really feel for the characters. These characters could be living today. And it's really beautiful and tragic and sad.
I definitely know which books I'm going to buy next when I go to a bookshop. Thank you very much. That was Arif Akbar, literary editor for The Independent. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next after the headlines is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Then at 2200 hours London time, it's The Monocle Daily with Peter Cardwell and Ted Kravitz. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.